Take this as a sign to call your 3-hour brunch friend. This is Frances Ha. Hey everyone, this is Seen and Heard. Welcome.
Welcome.
I'm Jackie.
I'm Greg.
And we're two Hollywood assistants. I'm doing the intro this time. It's fun.
Yeah.
We're two Hollywood assistants who watch every movie on Sight and Sound's Top 100 Greatest Films of All Time list. However, that's not the only thing we do. We have another series in our show called Personal Prince, in which we talk about our personal greatest films of all times lists. Each of us individually.
It's been a while, too.
It's been a while.
It's been so like half a year since we've done one.
No.
Yeah, just about.
What?
Yeah.
How's that possible?
It's just...
When was the last
September or October.
That's not half a year.
Just about, yeah. 5 or 6 months. September was like 6 months ago.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Yikes. Anyway, I think the last one I did was Moulin Rouge.
Yes.
Wow.
I believe so.
That was a long time ago.
Yeah. But the last Personal Prince we did was Housekeeping.
With the great Christine Lottie.
Yeah.
Anyway, so it's my turn again this time. And I chose a very formative movie for me called Frances Ha by Noah Baumbach. And
yes, you did.
Yeah, I did. And I will explain a little bit more as to why. We don't do what have you been watching with these ones because they kind of exist out of time.
Yep.
So, sorry.
We kind of just get right into it, yeah.
Let's just get into it.
Should we do it? Mm-hmm. From 2012, this is Noah Baumbach's Frances Ha.
Frances Ha was released in 2012. It was directed by Noah Baumbach, co-written by Baumbach and Greta Gerwig. Cinematography by Sam Levy. The film doesn't have a traditional score, but some music was written by Britta Phillips and Dean Wareham. 27-year-old Frances lives in Brooklyn with her best friend Sophie. They are basically the same person, but with different hair. Or so Frances thought. She's heartbroken when Sophie moves out of their apartment to live in Manhattan with some other girls. Frances then moves in with Benji and Lev, two aspiring artists, while she herself pursues a career at a dance company. Still an understudy and child instructor, she longs to join the company as an official member. Her and Sophie drift apart as Sophie becomes more serious with her boyfriend, Patch. When Patch gets a job in Japan, Sophie moves out of the country. Frances takes an impulse trip to Paris for a weekend, which is horrible, and decides to work as an RA at her alma mater, Vassar. She runs into Sophie, who is there for an alumni auction. Sophie gets drunk and reveals that she's engaged to Patch, but does not want to live in Tokyo. She sleeps over in Frances's dorm, but leaves in the morning. Frances takes a job as a secretary at the dance company and uses the money to rent a small studio where she finally lives on her own. She choreographs her first dance show and puts it on with the support and encouragement of her mentor, her former roommates, Sophie, and ultimately herself. The film stars Greta Gerwig as Frances Holliday, Mickey Sumner as Sophie Levy, Adam Driver as Lev Shapiro, and Michael Ziegen as Benji. The film premiered at Telluride Film Festival and had a limited release, but shortly after got its Criterion Blu-ray release. The film was shot entirely on a Canon EOS 5D Mark II, which is just a consumer DSLR, and the budget was spent instead on shooting locations. So it was shot in Sacramento, Paris, New York, Vassar, which is actually where Baumbach went to college. It had a $3 million budget.
I bet the songs, too. A lot of the money went towards the songs.
And yeah, Greta Gerwig and Noah Baumbach first met in 2010 when she starred in Greenberg. They went on to collaborate on another film after Frances Ha, Mistress America, which, similar to Frances Ha, Gerwig co-wrote and stars in. The soundtrack includes many pop songs as well as music made famous by the iconic French New Wave. So there's music from Bed and Board, Contempt, 400 Blows. A lot of Georges Delerue is, he's the composer that did a lot of the music for the French New Wave and appears in the movie. The scene where she runs to Modern Love by Bowie is a recreation of a scene from Mauvais Sang by Léos Carax, where Denis Levant runs in the streets to the same song. Did you know that it was like a recreation of that scene?
I actually didn't. I haven't seen that movie.
Yeah. And those are my specs.
No, those are your initial thoughts.
Those are my initial thoughts. That's what I think initially when I see this.
Yeah.
What are your initial thoughts?
Yeah. So I think we've talked about Baumbach before of I'm hot and cold on him. I think for every good film he has one that's a dud. It's interesting that he's, I think, such an wildly inconsistent filmmaker. But when he's good, and I know a lot of people who are serious about film who just straight up can't stand him. Like, they don't like Noah Baumbach. A lot of people think he works best as, like, a co-writer with, like, the Wes Anderson scripts and stuff. I generally like him. I really like Squid and the Whale. I like Meyerowitz stories a lot. Mm-hmm. And I really love Marriage Story. Mm-hmm. Other than that, I can kind of like leave a lot of the rest, but this film I do really like. I first saw this a couple years after it came out, and I really connected with it. I was in my 20s when I saw it.
That's perfect.
And I very instantly was, you know, I saw what he was doing with the French New Wave stuff and with the Woody Allen stuff, mm-hmm. and immediately connected with it. But I think it ultimately does transcend its homage, right? Because it's very intentionally from the black and white to like the way that the titles are and the use of the Georges Delerue music, like it is very intentionally like in that style, like to a point of like it's homage. It's like what Tarantino does with like grindhouse movies. Like it's the same thing where like it's there. I think it transcends it. Watching this again in my now mid-30s, the first third or so was like a little, I think when it's all just like millennials, I think especially when the stretch of the movie where she lives with Adam Driver and the other guy, it's like a little much. And I think even some of the dialogue between her and her friend, wait, sorry, what's her friend?
Sophie.
I think some of that's like a little written and it's like people don't talk that way. Almost like a Gilmore Girls, like
Gilmore Girls.
Sure. Yeah. I feel like there's the Gilmore Girls like cadence going on in some of the earlier scenes. So watching this again. Okay. I'm trying to phrase this in a way that doesn't upset you because I really like the movie. It's a movie I've seen 3 or 4 times. And I feel like every time I see it, it loses a little bit of
maybe
its power.
Because you're growing up a little.
I think so. But like to my delight, like last night while I was rewatching this and like the first third happened and I'm like, oh, this is like a little too much. The film really does like it won me over and I'm so happy. Cause it's not a film I know by the back of my hand. Like I said, in the last 10 years since it came out, I've seen it like 3 or 4 times. I really like it. I really like it. And I think the strength of the film is that it's ultimately optimistic and ends on this really beautiful, hopeful note and is so empowering and so just like someone on Letterboxd said this, so I can't really take credit, although I'm paraphrasing, but it's like the way that it's able to be so like melancholy, but then also really hopeful and full of life is like this really beautiful thing because that's what life is. It is this combination. It's the highs and lows. And yeah, while I'm at the age right now where I don't really care about stories about people in their 20s anymore, because it's just like that's in my rearview mirror, you know, it's really well done. It's really well done. And I honestly think it's mostly to do with Greta Gerwig. It's not just her performance, but, you know, she wrote the script with Baumbach and it feels much more like one of her films than it does Baumbach. And yeah, so I really dig it. I love the music. I love although I have to say this right now, big mistake shooting on the Canon 5D. Big mistake because it looks bad.
I don't think it looks bad.
It looks bad. It really does look bad.
I don't think it does.
Because it has this really, really digital, nasty look to it that I absolutely detest. I hate that look.
But it's part of it. I think it's part of it. I think it is part of this kind of like, we were talking about mumblecore before this. I think that's part of kind of the genesis of the movie.
But here's the thing. I think because...
He could have used it on camera. And this was like the first thing he shot digitally.
I think, and again, too, this came out in 2012. Digital cameras are still kind of like they've come a long way since then. You know, 28 Days Later was just like 10 years before this. So like, I think what Sean Baker did a few years later with like Tangerine, where he like went with the iPhone, like is a much more, like that makes total sense for that movie. But I feel like using the 5D, it's like just a good enough camera that he should have either gone crappier or he should have stepped it up. And
it's tricky, right? Because he's trying to imitate New Wave, but then yes, he's trying to do it with digital.
Yeah, no, exactly. That's my problem with it, because it does have this New Wave feel. It's cut like a New Wave film. It sounds like a New Wave film. And it also feels like a 70s Woody Allen movie. Mm-hmm. The problem is none of those movies are digital.
Yeah, but then that's what I was saying. It's like it is part of kind of... The root of the movie was to make this like slimmed down, cut down movie. Go to a theater movie.
I can't. It's a choice that I literally cannot stand behind. Like, I think too, you know, what, this movie came out 11 years ago now. I think watching it, you know, on modern TVs, which is how I watched it last night, I think it looks bad. I think it's lit well, and I think it's framed well for the most part, but like, the actual image just looks... I hate that look. Like,
I don't have a problem with it.
It just looks overly digital. Hmm. And just like you lose some definition, and it just has this kind of nasty digital stuff happening in the frame that like it bugs me to no end. So like I can't... I think that was the absolute wrong call for this movie. I think he could have shot on 16 and like still made it for like next to no money. But...
You say that, but it's really expensive. Also, did you get my Harry Styles reference right now?
No,
you didn't.
I don't even know Harry Styles. Like, is he from One Direction?
Your age is showing.
Is he from One Direction?
Yes.
Okay, yeah, I know that. What was the reference?
Well, when he was doing "Don't Worry, Darling" on the press tour of "Don't Worry, Darling," they asked him,
"Oh, why do you it's like a movie.
Movie. It's a go to a theater movie."
Jackie, I can guarantee that no one picked up on that reference. You're literally referencing an interview he did. For a movie
this
that no
the
one
age
saw.
Of the internet. Yeah. I don't have a problem with the way it looks at all.
Yeah,
like,
let's go
I
to
hear
you.
Right, I hear you, but it doesn't even faze me.
That's
and
great.
I don't think it looks bad. I genuinely don't. Let's go to me.
Yes. Okay.
I just want to say that when you Google this movie, one of the suggestions is, what is the point of Francis Ha? And I've noticed this because I Google a lot of movies for the podcast. A lot of movies I like, that's one of the first things that comes up. What is the point of, and that whatever movie I've Googled, which I just think is like hilarious, and I wanted to share. This is one of the first Criterions I ever bought. In fact, it's not the first, but like really, like,
what was
the
first
round? Inside Llewyn Davis.
Oh, okay.
This movie, I mean, it just means the world to me. Like, this was my first introduction to Greta Gerwig. It showed me what mumblecore is, although it's not like really, I mean, it's mumblecore.
Well,
it is. Yeah. No, it definitely is. It's just not like super cheap mumblecore. But it introduced me to that, and it's black and white and modern. And it might be the first like modern black and white movie I ever saw. Cause I mean, it came out in 2012. I was like young. I don't think I saw it until I was in college, and I wasn't watching a lot of movies. Like, I mean, I was, but like modern black and white was like very fresh to me and very like a new discovery.
You didn't grow up with like Ed Wood or something?
No, not Ed Wood. I'm trying to think of another one. I really am, but no. I mean, I'd seen Ed Wood before this probably, if I'm being honest. But like this really, like, it was the first time I noticed it and I was like, oh, that's important. It filled me with so much love, and the fact that it's so relatable and grounded and real, and it just changed my world. Like, I was fairly new to film. I wasn't pursuing it as a career, but every time I watch this, like, I'm inspired, I'm ready, and I'm excited about what I do. And that's how I feel after I watch this movie, and it makes me really, really happy. And yeah, it's just so important to me because of all these things I just said. I'm repeating myself, but there's just things in this movie that I say in life, like they've become colloquialisms for me. Like,
I've heard you say the 3-hour brunch friend,
3-hour brunch friend, all the time. Ahoy, sexy.
Oh yeah.
Like when they're talking about the story of them and they talk about like, we'll speak at graduations, Like, I say that all the time. Like, that's like a goal of mine. Like, it's just, this movie is so ingrained in me. I feel like I'm asking a question. I always, anytime my hand like is like up. A movie afternoon, although I call it an afternoon movie. Let's have a movie afternoon.
Right, right, right.
It's just, and I know it's so cliche to like be a girl and love this movie, like a girl who's like an artist and love this movie, but it's just,
I've never
met another girl who doesn't like this movie. And that's, yeah. I know, I'm not saying there's anything bad about that, but I do realize the cliche. I just want to put that out there. I recently made my boyfriend watch it. He'd never seen it. And while we were watching it, he's just like, oh my God, like this is, he's like, I see you in this so much. And I'm like, yeah, that's the point. So this is when we started The Personal Prince. I'm like, definitely has to be, one of them has to be Frances Ha. And Greta Gerwig instantly became like this hero to me after this. And this, like I said, I wasn't really pursuing film, but then like when I watched it again, the second time I watched it, I was just like, I want to be this person so bad. And that still stands today. She's one of my heroes. And this was my introduction to her.
Right, right. I think it's interesting how awkward she is in this movie.
Oh my God. She is giving the performance of a lifetime. So awkward.
It's such a choice to make her that socially awkward.
And I watched like this interview. Actually, it was her talking to Sarah Polley. It's on the disc. And she's talking about her performance and talking about making her super clumsy. And it's such a good choice to make her a dancer and that really clumsy, tall person.
Yeah.
It's such a good choice. She compared it to, like she said, like she basically wanted it to be like a performance only she could do. Like only she could be this person, you know?
Yeah.
The eating too fast. I love how she like eats too fast and just her jerky, like weird. I don't know. I'm not like that. I'm not saying like, when I say like my boyfriend watching is like, oh my God, there's so much of you in this. It's just like the way they like the things they talk about and things like that.
The feeling, the feeling.
Of course. Yeah. Yeah, I'm not that tall or jerky. But that's how I feel about this movie. I'm just so happy. It's instant serotonin for me to watch this movie.
Yeah.
And it is sad too. That's what makes it so great. It is melancholy, but it is so hopeful. And like, we'll talk about it. I don't want to get too deep into it. But
so I know online, you know, reading through Letterboxd, prepping for this episode, a lot of people, it was a common theme that Greta just didn't want to direct the movie herself because she co-wrote it and stars in it and everything. So that's why Noah did it. Do you think, how much of the success of the film do you attribute to Greta versus Noah?
Oh, like 90% Greta.
Yeah, I agree because none of his other movies quite feel like this.
This movie is so inherently female is one of my points, actually. It's just like it can't have been like the way that they described it is that they wrote separately. Like she would write a scene, he would write a scene. They would email it to each other and discuss. But I can't imagine that she wasn't more instrumental than he was because it is so inherently female and so hurt. Like if you've seen Lady Bird, it really like.
Yeah.
It's kind of.
Do you have a favorite? You probably this, right?
Yeah, probably. But she directed Lady Bird. Right. I love Lady Bird. Love. But this is special because it's like her, you know?
Well, yes and no. I think it's weird the way that Frances Ha has kind of lasted where Lady Bird, I don't want to say it's been forgotten, but it kind of fell by the wayside. Like, yeah, it was big at award season. But I feel like people more people talk about Frances Ha than they talk about Lady Bird.
I don't know about that.
Because I think her touch on Lady Bird is like, it's just great. Like, again, because I am hot and cold on Noah Baumbach, and I think that
this is my favorite Baumbach movie, and like he co-wrote it with her, you know?
You know what? I'll say this. My favorite Baumbach is Squid and the Whale, solely because it's one of the only films of his that feels really, really authentic. Because again, it's autobiographical. Mm-hmm. This is autobiographical for Greta. That's autobiographical for Noah. Yeah. And like, I feel like he so knows how to handle that story because it is essentially his like childhood and his parents separating.
But yeah, like how I said, like this is so inherently female. It's like just like her friend saying, like, don't pick at your face, like Sophie saying that. And just like sleeping in the same bed as her best friend. And there's so much more about it. And just the way they talk about men It's like, I don't think a man could have
wrote
that.
Yeah. Absolutely.
When they're talking about their boyfriends, and it's so funny and it's so real.
Patch.
Oh. But this is a love story, right? Between friends.
Right.
Like, this is a purely friend love story, which I think is so beautiful. And Mistress America is similar too, but it's about stepsisters.
So Noah directed that one, right?
He directed that one.
It's so funny.
Again,
because
she co-wrote it with him. And it's one of my favorite Bombach movies.
See, I saw that when I came out, and then it completely left my head.
You
and
should
I,
watch
I
it
I actually
again.
Could not tell you anything that happens on that
you
movie.
You should watch it again. It's great. It's great. If you like Frances Ha, I mean, the chances are you're going to like Mistress America.
I mean, I remember thinking it was pretty good, but I just don't remember anything from it.
It's really good. Yeah.
Is this the film where they like fell in love?
Well,
because he was with Jennifer Jason Leigh, right?
Yeah.
And they had like a baby. Did he leave her when she was pregnant or something?
I don't think so.
Or they had like a baby.
I don't know that. I know that their child was very young when their divorce got finalized. But their divorce got finalized in 2013. This movie came out in 2012.
Oh, yeah. I think that lines up. Again, I'm not throwing any shade his way. My mom is that way. Like, we'll bring up a celebrity and she'd be like, oh, like she's talking about Neil Young. She's like, I don't like Neil Young because he left his wife of 50 years for Daryl Hannah.
Your moms are like that.
And I'm like, get over it. Like, it doesn't, who know? You weren't there to see his marriage. Yeah. Like, how do you know? Like, maybe it was a mutual thing. Her whole thing is like, oh, Andy Garcia, he's a good man. He's been with his wife for 70 years.
Like that too. Her idols are Paul Newman. Yeah, like Paul Newman's one of her idols because
Joanne Woodward.
Yeah, to Joanne Woodward for so long.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, like, they did Greenberg before this.
How are you on Greenberg?
I like it.
I think it's fine.
I'm not crazy about it. I do like it, though. I love like all the assistant stuff in Greenberg. And she is an assistant. And like it opens with her driving around LA. And it's just like, that is my life. That's another thing about Greta. It's just like, and this is so cliche, but I just feel like she really gets me. Like she and just like seeing her start a movie in a car driving around LA being an assistant, and I'm like, that's literally me. It's I don't know,
yeah,
something special.
Yeah.
But I like Greenberg, but after Greenberg he wanted to work with her again, and so that's kind of where this came from.
I think Greenberg kind of has like sad white boy syndrome.
Yeah, it does. It totally does. And a lot of his movies do, to be completely
and
honest.
He's like the Ben Stiller character in Greenberg is like pretty
really
affluent
annoying.
Too. He's like has a bunch of money, which is honestly I think that's one of the things that makes Frances Ha so endearing, is that she's just a normal, like her
normal
parents
gal.
Live in the suburbs in Sacramento, and she's struggling with money, and like that's what makes this so relatable.
Yeah.
Over a lot of his other films.
Yeah, Mistress America's like that too. You'd like it. But
I mean, I saw it.
No, I know, but like you should watch it again.
Yeah.
Another thing is like this is the one of the first Criterion essays I ever read. Probably the first one.
Like the booklet?
So I opened my booklet. Well, when I was like prepping for the episode, I opened my booklet and I have like underlinings. Like I underlined stuff in it. It means so much to me. But in that essay, it's by Annie Baker, and it really is like, it's such a good essay. And she's the one that first, like, it starts with, like, this is a love story, but it's not between friends. It's actually with herself. And I was like, oh, yes, it is.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's just, it's so quotable. Like I said, that when they're talking about the boyfriends and she says, like, everything important is covered up. Everything that matters is covered up. And, yeah, Pat, she's the kind of guy who says, Patch. I gotta take a leak.
Yeah.
And wears pre-distressed baseball hats. That's the best.
There's a certain, I'll say that when she's living with Adam Driver and the other guy, there's a certain way that they interact with each other that feels a little bit false, of like them busting in and like laying on each other's beds.
It's very
and like,
cute.
Yeah, it's a little, that stuff's cute. Like a little too cute. If that was toned down just a little bit.
But what's great about it is that it's never a love triangle.
Right.
She never like gets with either of them.
Mm-hmm.
I love like her making them omelets like late at night. And then I love them like eating bagels in the morning, hungover, like stuff like that. I do love still. Like I'm still in that era of mine. but I agree. It's very cute of them like attacking her on the bed. But I think Benji likes her. Like that's part of it too. He definitely likes her.
Right. They keep making her dance and like.
Oh, I like that though.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like, that's the stuff for me. Like, if I have a problem with this movie, it's just that stuff of like, it's a little too much. But I love so much of the rest of the film that I can like forgive that stuff.
But they're really annoying, the boys. And I think that's the point. They are the rich white boy syndrome. Like, right. They're like these privileged, quote, artists
who don't work.
It's after three, I can drink.
And they're complaining like, about taking loans from their parents.
Inside, but I think that's the point. Like, the whole smoking inside is like, they're that cliche, you know?
Yeah.
But I feel like they are knowingly being those characters, except in a French New Wave film, like, this would be a love triangle.
And yeah, it's true. And who can't relate to the guy, the guy who's not Adam Driver, I forget his name, but the guy who literally is like, yeah, I'm writing a spec for SNL. And then later he's like, no, I'm not SNL. Like, SNL sucks now anyway. It's just
Yeah, exactly. You know what's another great quote I love? I love, like, any time Frances has to justify how close her and Sophie are. And I love when she's,
we're basically,
like,
the same person.
Basically the same person with different hair. We went to college together and we're the same person. That's one of them. But it's that, it's such a girl thing. Like I said, like, this movie's so feminine and this love is so pure. It's like having to prove to other people how close you are to someone. Mm-hmm. Like, she says, like, we're best friends. She's been to my house for Christmas like three times.
Right.
Such a, like, good,
yeah,
classic thing of, like, you get so defensive if, like, this person is coming in and saying, like, actually I'm closer to her than you are.
Right. No, yeah, like, that's so relatable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Stop treating like a 3-hour brunch friend. That's just, I mean, what more is there to say about that?
I didn't even know brunch was a thing in New York.
Oh my god. Brunch in New York City is like,
I thought it was in L.A.
No, it's an institution in New York.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And yeah, it is.
I had zero brunches in New York. I guess I was doing it wrong.
Yeah.
She has a quote in here. She's either talking about a book or a film, but literally Frances says, the animals, because it's an anthropomorphic thing, and she's like, the animals have to either talk or be at war for me to be interested.
It's really good.
So Frances would not like Balthazar or Io.
She's like you. Another thing about, like, I don't know, and especially even now, like, that I'm watching it, like, a lot of my friends are getting married and, like, moving on. And I am 27, actually. This is my first time watching it as being 27.
That's special.
It is.
I think
it is.
You
it
just
was
feel
a
so
sad.
Seen.
I know. I feel seen, but also a little sad because then in a year, I'll be past it. But I know I'm still going to enjoy it.
Yeah, but you're further along in your life than Frances is at the same age.
I mean, I guess, but I still live at home with my parents.
Yeah, but Frances doesn't do her first thing. She doesn't stage her first thing till the end of the film.
That's
where you've
true.
Made two short films already. And you have a film podcast.
I do have a film podcast, and it's fun. But I love what she says about, if something funny happens on the way to the deli, you only tell Patch and I'll never know about it. It's so sad, but that is what you experience when your friends get married. I don't know. At least girls.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, it's kind of interesting because this is such a millennial film.
Oh my God.
And I think for our parents' generation, it was different. I think for our parents' generation, once you kind of got married, it was this like being whisked away to like, you know, because for a lot of our parents did not, I know my parents, like, did not live together before they got married and all this stuff. And so, like, when you got married, it did mean the end of a certain era.
Yeah.
And I found that with me, you know, I got married last year and I have a few friends that have been married recently or married for a few years. And, like, that's not the case at all, I think. I think it changed with our generation. Sort of like it didn't mean, okay, you're not going to see your friends anymore. Unless, of course, you were, like, moving to another country.
Right.
But, yeah, interesting how that works.
I mean, I've experienced that.
Oh, you have?
Oh, yeah, totally.
Like, a friend got married and then you just, like, don't.
Yeah.
You're not as close anymore.
Oh, naturally, yeah.
Yeah.
I love, okay, speaking of, like, now we're getting into really nitty gritty, but I love, you said she does, like, her thing, the choreography at the end, but it really is, like, she gives up her hope to be a dancer. And then choreography is kind of like the fallback. I don't want to say the fallback, but it's her adjusting into the new role. But I love when she's at the dinner and she's talking to that guy and he goes,
the lawyer.
Like, what do you do? Yeah. And she goes, it's kind of complicated. And he goes, oh, like, what you do is complicated? And she's like, no, because I don't do it.
Yeah.
And that's, like, so perfect.
Yeah.
That's it. That it, like, I've experienced that. You've experienced that. Anyone who pursues the arts experiences that. And
yeah, because you're like, what I'm doing right now is not necessarily relevant to what I really do or really want to do.
You can never get people to understand that or actually understand that. That's the fate of trying to do, of trying to be something, you know, like that's the trajectory. It's like you don't do the actual thing you want to do until later.
Yeah.
Or you have to discover what that is. It's not a path. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think to that realization, because she's tall.
She's so tall. Exactly.
She's this big, and you know, dancers kind of have to be like all of our best dancers are short and kind of compact. And And so, her just accepting, like, okay, like it's not for me, but I can still be involved with it in this different capacity.
And I love that she takes the job as like being a secretary at the dance.
Wait, does she take it?
Yeah. Yeah. I thought she didn't take it. No, that's how she's able to afford to live on her own.
Oh, I thought it's because she was working for the university that she went to.
No, that's just her summer job.
Oh.
She accepts the job because there's a scene in the office with her boss who, oh my God, I forgot to write this down. Yeah, no, she accepts it.
Oh, I guess I missed that part.
So this movie is like several years after post-grad, but she's still like clinging on to this romantic roommate lifestyle, right?
Well, I think it's too, it's a regression because when you're in school, you feel safe because it's
exactly.
Like, you know what you're doing the next day, you know what's expected of you and you don't really have to work.
Yeah.
And yeah, so it's this like comfort.
And it's exactly. And she even takes the comfort of taking that job in the summer and like, kind of pretend being a student again, and it's so sad when she can't even take the classes.
Yeah And she's so much older than everybody else.
It breaks my heart. I know. It really breaks my heart. It's a harsh reality, and that's what I mean. This movie is melancholy. It's really sad. But I think the thing that makes it hopeful is kind of this style of new wave, because I feel like generally new wave films, I mean, they're light on their feet. A lot of the time, they don't take life too seriously. They're pretty lighthearted, these new wave films. And I think making the movie in that vein is what makes it so not depressing.
I think too, yeah, if you took out all the music and all the shots like lasted a little bit longer, this would be like really depressing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And Greta even said in that interview, like she sent it to friends and they got back to her saying like, this is really sad. And she's like, no, it's not sad at all. And especially the dinner scene.
Oh, yeah.
Like, they said that dinner scene is, like, unbearably sad.
That dinner scene is, it's interesting how awkward they decided to make that whole thing. Like, it is so fucking awkward.
It is. It totally is. But yeah, this kind of, and then Noah Baumbach was actually talking to Peter Bogdanovich in an interview. It's on the disc. And he tells Peter about the scene where they have the picnic, and it's that swelling new wave music and just that like romance of it. And God, I think it's such a good use of music in this movie.
Yeah, for sure.
I think it's doing a lot of work.
It's doing some heavy lifting. Yeah, I agree.
But this free flowing, like, the line from the essay I wanted to read. I love this. And it's related to this, like, she exists in this romantic new wave world itself. So Annie Baker wrote, when Frances does a tightrope style walk along the Seine, is she intentionally aping Jeanne Moreau in Jules and Jim? Or is being an aspiring 20-something artist in a major city necessarily about trying, unconsciously or not, to make your life look like your favorite movie? And then does growing up simply mean letting go of the movie you thought your life would be?
Yeah.
Because how good is that?
I think it plays back into, you know, young women are always known for having like Audrey Hepburn posters. Like, I feel like most young women go through an Audrey Hepburn phase, and then it's like something that, you know, you grow out of.
Yeah.
And I think that's exactly, that's spot on.
It's spot on with like the form of the movie and the actual plot itself and how they're tied. And I really love that. I love when she goes, and it is about, obviously this is a coming of age story, and it's just so funny. Like, one of the big indicators for me is like, I love in the beginning when her and Sophie are like play fighting in the park. And then when she attacks Mammy Gummer.
Yeah.
It's so funny. Yeah. And Mammy Gummer is hilarious in this. She's so good. And of course, when Benji says 27 is old, though.
Oh, yeah.
Like, that just kills me. Especially because I'm 27 now.
Yeah, but you've outlived the 20s. Well, just wait till you're 28, and then you'll have outlived a bunch of people that died at 27. The 27 Club.
Oh, wow. The 27 Club.
27 is a big age. Yeah. Jim Morrison, Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix. I think Kurt Cobain, they were all like 27.
Damn.
But you're going to be fine. Because you're not a partier.
What I love about it, though, is that it is melancholy. It is hopeful. It is her growing up. But in the end, like, I think that Frances Ha, like, cutting off her, actually putting her name in the mailbox, it's just such a nice, like, symbolic thing of, like, no, there's still work to do.
I think, yeah, there's work to do.
It's like she's still incomplete.
She's still, yeah, of course. I think it's that, and I think it's just about her adapting, right? Like,
exactly.
That's the situation. Like, there's only that much room in the mailbox for the label, and it's just like, oh, that's good enough.
Yeah.
Like, kind of letting go of some of the other stuff. Yeah.
Exactly.
Beautiful ending. Really beautiful ending. I love, one thing I really, really love about this movie is the way that it does travel. And so it feels very episodic.
Let's talk about
the whole film's very episodic.
Yeah. And it starts with the addresses, right? That's like new chapters.
Yeah. And I love even just like the, I love the Sacramento section. I feel like I like this movie, and then when the Sacramento section happens, I like love it.
It's so, so sweet.
My wife lived there for a while, and I have some very close friends in Sacramento, and there's just such a specific vibe there, and I know she's from there, and that's where Lady Bird takes place.
You know, those are her parents, right?
Those are her real parents, and I just love. Because there's such a thing, I think, when you first move out and you're out on your own and like move to a new city, it's this crazy, strange new thing where you're also, I think for some people, still kind of being assisted by your parents. I know when I first moved to LA and like my parents I would call them, you know, a couple months out of the year, be like, hey, I need a little help with rent this month. So you're still, it's this weird in-between phase. But when you go home for like the holidays, it's such a specific feeling because you've been thrust into adulthood, but you get to go home. And when you go home, you feel like you're a kid again.
Yeah.
And it's this weird thing of like sleeping in your old bed and like with your old posters on the wall. And like, it's this very bizarre feeling of like you've moved forward, but for these couple days out of the year, you get to go home and it feels like you're back. It's like time travel.
And you're safe and you're warm. And that's what's so lovely about it. So this was originally supposed to be like a 40-page section.
Really?
With like actors and full scenes and everything. And then they decided not to do that, which I think is such a good move, like to actually use her parents, to actually use her hometown. And like, it's just so warm and there's no arguments. Like usually like someone goes home for the holidays and it's like, oh, my parents don't get me, or like there's some friction there, right? Like think of like, have you seen The Family Stone?
Yeah, I have seen it.
Think of like The Family Stone, but this is literally just montage, goes home for the holidays, has a great time. Like warm, sad, sweet, matching it with the escalator going down and going up. Oh, that kills me. When she says bye, I love you, and she's like going up the escalator and she's crying and like, it makes me so sad.
Yeah.
And warm.
Yeah.
I don't know.
No, I love that. It's such a unique thing. And I always like envied people who came from the East Coast. Like being in LA, a lot of people I know are from the East Coast. They grew up on the East Coast. So when they'd go home for the holidays, they'd get to go home to like, it's just a bigger trip and there's like snow and, but it's just, it's surreal seeing Sacramento in this movie. And I grew up in a place, I grew up out two hours outside of Sacramento, but a very similar feeling, kind of like just super suburby place.
Yeah.
And I love the juxtaposition of like the New York of the film and then going back to Sacramento and then back to New York and like,
then Paris.
And then Paris.
Let's talk about Paris. I think one of the reasons this movie works so well is that the Paris trip is a disaster. Like, I think that's what makes this movie.
Like, she just did not think this through.
No. And like, you think a movie that's like trying to imitate the new wave, like when she actually goes to Paris, it's going to be like super nice, but it's just horrible. And I love that about it.
Yeah, yeah. I think, well, it's not that it's horrible. It's just that it's just unremarkable.
Unremarkable and kind of a disaster. Like, she takes a sleeping pill, she sleeps through it all. That my heart sinks. Like, when she wakes up and the alarm is like 4 in the afternoon, ugh, the first time I saw it, I was just like, no.
Yeah, she just had like the one day.
Yeah, did not think it through. Had the one day. All this horrible irony, has nothing, like stores are closed. She doesn't really know where to, she can't get in touch with her friend who lives there. And then of course, when she's coming back to the city, the friend calls and you're just like, ugh.
That scene for me is one of the most relatable in the movie, not because that's happened to me, but just that sense of like you've missed out in such a big way. Yeah. Because you just like didn't think this through and you.
Yeah. I know, exactly.
Because she's even exactly. Like, oh, there's a guy at the party
Jean-Pierre
that looks,
Leon,
yeah, Jean-Pierre Leone. And he's single and like I think you'd like him.
It's and like, she goes, oh, I'm so excited.
Yeah, she's in this cab on the way home.
It hurts me. I know that scene hurts me. Yeah. But I think that's why I like the movie so much. I mean, that's just one of the reasons I love the movie so much, is that like he didn't go into that cutesy new wave. I'm in Paris.
Oh, that would have been
Jules and Jim.
Such the wrong move.
I know.
Yeah. And I think too, just the way she comes back. She comes back when she does because she has the interview with the boss at the dance
and then
company.
The boss is like, can't. Your heart just keeps sinking. That whole Paris thing, that's why I call it a disaster. It's just one thing after another of just like hitting your forehead.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it's great. Her thinking of this trip of like, oh, I'm going to go to Paris by myself on a whim and like stay at my friend's like family's house. Like, but it ends up like she's expecting this like catharsis from it, or this like moment.
Young woman goes to city on a whim. Yeah.
She thinks just by going to the city of Paris that it's going to be this like transformative thing for her. And then it turns out no.
And notice there's no French new wave music when she's actually in Paris.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's everyone's a winner. That's the only song.
Yeah.
It's so good. It's so good.
Yeah, it really is.
I love another thing I really love is that Patch is like, he starts as kind of this like, they talk about him kind of how he's like this like douchey guy, but then it develops like she becomes closer to him and like she sees less of Francis. And it's always interesting when someone, you start out not liking someone and then like, oh, you're actually gonna end up with this person. And I think that's such an interesting move. But it's also like, they don't make him a douche. He's not actually a douche. Like, they're just met, like they're just, I don't know.
He just
They're
has
just
a
girls
dumb name.
Being girls. Yeah, Patch, and does stupid stuff, I guess. But I really love that at the end when they're back at Vassar, she says like, I like you, Patch. Like, and he goes, I like you too, Francis. And it's just sweet. It's, I don't know.
Yeah.
It's a nice touch that he's not actually, you know, he's not actually a douche.
Right, right. He's just basic.
Yeah. But the story of us, so lovely.
Yeah. God, yeah, no, I mean, it's such a, this film is so important to so many people for such good reason. And I think, when I saw it, I was the perfect age to see it for the first time. I think it's a film that, like, if you are past a certain age, like, if you see this for the first time in your 50s, I mean, I would still think you would be able to relate because you're recalling your own 20s, but, like, it is a very specific existence in your 20s. Like,
totally.
It's the creative type who went to a big city to with these impossible dreams and kind of got, you know, I like that the circle of friends, everyone's going to each other's shows, like the art openings or like everyone's very, like in a Woody Allen movie, everyone's talking about the exhibit at the Met and like this painter and like, so it is this very kind of like, it's a bubble, right? And I can also see why people hate this movie.
Yeah, because, if you have nothing to relate to it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it is about a certain, you know, upper intellectual, like, you know, type.
Totally.
So yeah, I can see how it would be like people fucking hate it too.
It's the way that a lot of people hate Girls. And like, I feel like Girls is pretty,
it's similar.
Because
Girls was already on before this movie came out.
Same year. Girls came out 2012.
It started in 2012?
I'm pretty sure, yeah. But it is, I mean, it's all this mumblecore. It's going back to mumblecore, really.
I would argue that, you're right, Girls did start in 2012. I would argue that this is not mumblecore.
I think it is.
Because to me, mumblecore is stagnant, usually, not necessarily in a bad way.
You're right, this is very high budget mumblecore.
As someone who, like, when I was in a directing class and I put on this thing, all the comments came back, they're like, this is some mumblecore shit. I feel like, because would you call Jules and Jim mumblecore? Would you call Annie Hall mumblecore? Because
Annie Hall is like a predecessor to mumblecore.
No, I don't think so.
I think so. Yeah, maybe it has a lot more technique in it and a lot more stuff going on, but I just mean like, I think it's a predecessor. I think Woody Allen, Cassavetes, and Jim Jarmusch, like we said, are like predecessors for mumblecore.
Cassavetes and Jarmusch, absolutely. Because I feel like they, their films have a much slower pace. I guess for me, mumblecore just has to be like pretty uneventful. And this film is full of like incidents, you know, like her running, going out to dinner and her running to the ATM and coming back and her going to Paris, her going home for ATM, Christmas.
The ATM.
There's just, it's like, I feel like it's way too lively to be true mumblecore. But again, what is mumblecore? And I feel like that term is often used in a derogatory way.
Yeah. I don't know why.
But yeah, I think of the Duplass brothers and, you know.
Have you seen Hannah Takes the Stairs?
I haven't, no.
So Hannah Takes the Stairs is with Greta Gerwig and she was one of the writers on it. It's good. It's no Francis Ha, but it is so like, it's so clear to see the path from like Hannah Takes the Stairs to Greenberg to Francis Ha to then being the director of Lady Bird. Like that's incredible.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah. No, I don't know.
Mumblecore is, you're right. It's like way less events. That's what I mean. I think this is high budget mumblecore.
High budget, but it's not even.
it's classy mumblecore.
But that would infer that mumblecore is unclassy normally.
It's not. It's not. Mumblecore is unclassy.
I would say.
Would you call like girls mumblecore?
No.
But it is.
I don't think
kind
so.
Kind of. It's but like mumblecore makes... for TV. It is.
No, because it's Seinfeld mumblecore?
No.
What?
Well, actually, yeah.
See, exactly. Yeah. No, I think when I think mumblecore, I think of Duplass or I think of the early films of Jim Jarmusch, especially like Stranger Than Paradise or something, where it's like, it's just a lot of space and there's a lot of just like long shots where we're kind of observing people from a distance and...
You know, yeah, you know, Daddy Long Legs by the Safdie Brothers is considered mumblecore.
Hmm. I love that film. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I don't know if I agree with that.
That's okay.
Yeah. I don't know. Mumblecore is a very specific. It's not a, I don't think of that term often. Like I don't go around thinking about mumblecore. Like is this mumblecore or is it not mumblecore?
I mean, no one's telling you to do that.
But whatever it is has fallen out of favor. I think by 2023, don't you think?
Yes. I think so.
Yeah.
But I think it comes from what you said. It's like we are in a time. But here's the thing. I don't think mumblecore has gone out of style. I think this exactly what you said, the white boy, rich white boy syndrome. That is so like a lot of people are really over it. And I totally get it. And so I think that those mumblecore movies, I think the technique of mumblecore can be used and should be used in all communities. Like, I think that would be really cool. But the fact that it was this very specific group of people doing it. Yeah, that's fallen out of favor.
Right, right.
But I think everyone should use the technique of like, yeah, you want to make a movie? Like, make it. Try it.
Right. I think the only thing that stops me from thinking of this as a mumblecore film is the fact that...
Black and white.
Well, no, not that at all, but just that mumblecore films to me are completely driven by the dialogue, where it's like so much of this film is told visually.
Yeah, it is. The running.
Yeah, the running, the music, the way it's cut.
Yeah.
I think
can be semi... mumblecore.
I really think this film is partly. It's half Truffaut and it's half Woody Allen. That's exactly this movie.
Yeah.
But again, it, you know, so what? Everything comes from somewhere.
Well, I love it. Should we do sight and sound?
Let's do it.
This is so hard. The sound is really hard.
Too bad. Just pick one.
Okay. No. You're going to laugh.
Sight.
Sight? Yeah. It's got to be that's Sophie. She's my best friend. It's the shots of them looking at each other at the end. It's got to be. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
It's that or, I mean, her running, the modern love sequence. But that's a perfect union of sight and sound. If I'm doing sight only, it's got to be the end of like the two. It's just her looking at Sophie looking at her. But I also really love like at the end when she's just written down her name and it kind of zooms in. It's really lovely.
Yeah.
On her face, like after she's written it.
Yeah.
Those are my sights.
That's the first time you see her last name too.
Yeah. I know. It's so fun because you're like, what's this Francis Ha business?
Yeah.
And then at the end, you finally get it.
Yeah.
What's yours?
You know, I don't know. there's a lot in this movie. I think maybe it's the scene where she's walking through the woods, probably like Central Park, and she's talking to her mom on the phone.
No, that's Vassar.
Oh, that's the college.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I love that shot. Yeah. And again, it's like, you know, it's on the nose, but it's like her by herself
in the woods,
in the woods, talking to her mom and kind of like smoothing, you know, in terms of like, oh no, in the way that you do talk to your parents when you're living on your own in a big city and you're like, oh yeah, it's fine. And
yeah,
you hear the parents on the phone like, no, I told you not to ask her that, you know.
Yeah,
I like
it's
that.
Great.
I like that shot. Yeah. What about your sound?
This is so hard because all of the quotes that I just said, like those are all my favorite sound, but like, I'm going to go with a silly one just because I want to. Because when I first saw this movie and I saw like this happened, I was laughing so, so hard. And it's when she's in Paris and she goes to the cinema. And this is what she asks to see.
Hello. When did Puss in Boots start?
How did I know you were going to pick that? I honestly knew.
That is perfect to me. Like, and that's exactly what I mean. You think like she's in Paris. It's going to be like Vive Sa Vie. She goes to see like this great movie. And she literally goes and asks what time Puss in Boots start. And it's just perfect. Especially because I do love the first Puss in Boots. I think it's a great movie. So, yeah.
I have yet to see it.
It's really fun.
Nice.
What's your favorite sound?
Well, my favorite sound is there are some great lines and there are also some really great music cues in here.
Yeah.
And I think my favorite music cue is there's a Harry Nilsson song called Mrs. Butter's Lament. I'm a huge Harry Nilsson fan. And it's a deep cut, mm-hmm. okay, from his discography, from his, you know, oeuvre.
Mm-hmm.
And they just use the backing. So it's like the instrumental version, which I've never even heard before. So he just uses it. But it's the sequence where she's working at Vassar.
Mm-hmm.
And it's literally because there's lyrics. His voice goes over right. that song, but they're just using right. the instrumentation. And I thought, first of all, Harry Nilsson deep cut. Yay. And the fact that they just use like you if you didn't know any better, you'd be like, oh, this is like part of the score yeah. for the film. Yeah, I'll play a clip right here.
You're scary.
Are you with the program?
Yes, I'm assisting.
Oh, great. So you're a teacher?
No, I'm not. I'm an RA, but I'm also a dancer.
I'm so sorry.
Oh, what?
Resident assistants can't take class.
But I'm not just an RA.
I'm so sorry. I don't make the rules.
You're a really good waitress.
Not a waitress. I just pour.
Nobody gave us any direction.
Like, you were supposed to be on duty 10 minutes ago.
Oh, I'm sorry. Shh.
Yeah. Had to go with the Harry Nilsson. The Bowie is tempting, but I feel like that scene is just so iconic. And I think, too, the fact that you said it was in the Leos Carax movie, mm-hmm. too. I'm like, mm-hmm. If I'm being completely honest, too, that maybe the twirling in the street is like almost too much for me.
Oh, my God. Then you've missed the point of the movie.
No, I haven't. I just think that's like a tad too twee.
I don't know about
because
that.
I've never seen anybody do that. That's not like coked out of their mind. Like,
but that's her character. She's a Hollywood dancer. Boulevard. What do you mean? What about when she's dancing in Central Park? Like,
I don't know. I mean, maybe I just haven't spent enough time in New York.
It's
maybe there's
movie.
More people dancing in the streets in New York.
Well, listen,
it's a movie, but it's also supposed to be a reflection of, you know, it's this intensely real.
But then it's also influenced by New Wave, which obviously was not.
That's
like,
true.
It's
that's
this
true.
Balance. And I think that's what I love about the New Wave. And that's what I love about this. It's
that's
like
true.
It is very true to life, but it is also very much a movie.
That's a, you know what? Good point. And I take back what I said because, right? Yeah, I'm thinking about like Jules and Jim. And there's, yeah. yeah. No, you're right. You're right.
Like, why is it okay for Jules and Jim
no,
to do
you're right.
it?
You're totally right.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
Well,
we would do Pauline here.
I think Pauline would like this.
You know, I think it's hard to say, actually.
Why?
Because
she's a wild card, or
she's a wild card, and I think it's such a like manipulative movie.
Yeah. No, you're right.
And I mean that in a good way.
Yeah.
But like she doesn't really, I feel like she doesn't always respond to those films.
Yeah.
Where you can like see the strings being pulled and, you know.
Yeah. I mean, it is subtle.
I don't know how subtle this film is.
It's pretty subtle. You didn't even realize she was working in the office.
That's true. But that's almost like a narrative lapse than it is. Like the, I think the it's themes not a lapse. Of the film.
You see the girl, the dancing, the woman, the dancer.
I think that the themes of the film are not subtle. And I think, yeah, that's a strength. That's a strength. But I don't.
I mean, yeah, that speech at the dinner is your person.
I don't think there's much about the film that is subtle. But I tend to lean towards films that are not so subtle.
Yeah.
So
we'll see.
I love that speech so much. I almost chose it as my favorite sound.
It's great.
It's really good.
Yeah, it's really good. But now we can move to Letterboxd.
Let's do it.
I have a 5-star review here that just says, "The way this movie holds you, gives you a kiss on the forehead, and then tells you everything is going to be okay."
Aww.
Sums it up.
That is so sweet.
That's the appeal.
Oh my goodness. 4 stars just because I literally said this. If nobody got me, I know Greta Gerwig got me.
Love it.
Yeah.
Someone gave it 5 stars and said, "Self-care is rewatching this movie."
Oh, it really is. This one I love. 5 stars. Frances Ha is to me what Godfather is to men.
That's totally valid. It's totally valid because we just did Godfather somewhat recently, and there's so many great lines in that movie about just like living your life and the code of which to live your life. And this film absolutely has all of that for millennials in New York.
Yes.
Yeah. Here's 0.5 star. So on the opposite end of the spectrum here, the biggest pile of millennial American self-centered shit. I despise this film. Seen it twice, and that's twice too many.
Why have they seen it twice if they despise it?
And they end with, "Don't let young, sexy Adam Driver fool you."
Oh my God. We didn't even talk about Adam Driver in the movie. I mean,
to be honest, he's not really that big of a part of it.
He's so funny, though. I think he is.
I don't know.
It's just the cadence of his voice. Like, just hearing him and, like, I don't know. What about when he puts his arm on her and she's like, eh?
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's great.
So good.
That's his one pass.
But I love how she, like, immediately, I love that she gets the tax rebate, right? And then asks him to dinner, and you're just like, wait, does she, ahoy sexy? Wait, we didn't even talk about ahoy sexy. We kind of did. Because you already can tell from that text that he's like kind of annoying.
Yeah.
And then they go to dinner, and it's like kind of weird. And then she has to go to the ATM, and she falls.
He makes that comment about sleeping with her later. Like,
yeah, exactly. And then they're in his apartment, and it's just like, no. Like, it's actually not going to work out. But she still went to his apartment. Like, she still is, like, hanging out, you know?
Yeah.
And I like that about it. It's fun.
Yeah, yeah.
I think he's great in it.
No, yeah, he's great in everything.
He really is.
Yeah.
Okay. 2 stars. I know, other end of the spectrum. I'm sorry, but I cannot fucking stand quirky New York City millennials. That's it.
It's fair.
And I want to end on a happy note. 5 stars. Why is this movie literally about everyone?
I mean, I wouldn't say that, but it's about a very specific...
Actually, yeah, that kind of goes against what we talked about. Wait, let me find another one then. Oh, okay. 5 stars. She feels like a bad mom in 1987. That's such a good quote.
Yeah.
Because, like, what a random year. Like, why 1987?
Because that was the year, the Reagan decade of American parents.
I see.
Well, because she says she's talking, like, smoking inside.
That's what she's saying.
No, it's great. Because, you know, look at all those old movies. All the parents are smoking indoors.
I know.
Even when I grew up in the 90s, I remember people smoking all over the place. There was smoking and non-smoking sections in restaurants. You remember those?
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah.
I remember that. But I don't think anyone ever lit up inside when I was young.
Oh, I had next door neighbors. I was friends with the kids. And so we'd be over there frequently, and they would just smoke right in front of us. So as a kid, I had all this secondhand smoke that luckily I haven't really been exposed to in like 25 years or whatever. Mm. But yeah, even at that age, I was like, this isn't great that I'm breathing all this in.
Yeah, no.
Well,
that was Frances Ha.
On that note of secondhand smoking, that was Frances Ha.
I love how the smoking is not excessive. Like, it's not like, yeah, it's like kind of new wavy, but in new wave movies, like, they're smoking all the time.
Yeah. Well, you, I don't think anyone in this movie is like an actual smoker. They're doing it literally because they're imitating.
Yeah,
exactly. They're doing a bit. It's part of their character.
Yeah. And she's like, I don't want to smoke alone. And it's like, give me a sip.
Yeah. Where does this rank for you on your favorite films list? Not, you don't have to give me a number.
Why
but just
do I have to rank things?
No, no. Like, don't give me a number, but like top what? Top 5, top 10, top 20, top 50. I'm assuming it would be on your top 50.
Definitely top 20, I would say.
Nice.
Top 10. Even 10 is like such a small number.
I know.
I don't know. It's definitely within 20.
Yeah.
I love it. What more can I say?
That's great.
It's just like it's part of me, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It'll never not be a part of me. I remember when I showed it to my sister and my best friend, and I was so nervous they weren't going to like it. I was literally like standing and staring at them, but they both loved it, which made me really happy. Because I saw Lady Bird with my best friend, and it was like a beautiful experience because she only watches movies with me, really. I mean, that's not true. She watches movies, but you know what I mean.
Like films.
Yeah,
films.
Yeah. So we went together. I said, like, there's this new movie out. We have to see it. So I took her. We went to the Lemley in Pasadena. I'll never forget it. Full house. I think it was opening weekend. It was so great. And she loved it. Like, she really, really loved it. And then a few years later, I was just like, wait, you haven't seen Frances Ha? So I put it in. Still, I was nervous because it's very different from Lady Bird. Like, I mean, it is and it isn't, but... And my sister, too. So we watched it, the three of us. And they loved it, and I was really happy.
It's a great feeling.
I know. So that's Frances Ha.
Cool.
Well, cool.
Yeah. Next week, we are back to our regularly scheduled programming, because we're doing Children of Paradise, the French film from, I want to say, 1945. I could be totally wrong on that. Marcel Carné, I believe, is the director. We didn't look... if that's wrong.
There's so many French movies on this list. Like, would you say the majority of the movies we've done are French?
I would say the overwhelming majority are French, yeah.
They really are. And Sight and Sound is a British magazine.
Yeah, but the French cinema thing is strong,
such
you know?
A thing, I know.
Yeah, speaking of...
I mean, look at this movie, yeah.
Criterion just announced their, I believe June releases, or is it July? I forget now, but they just announced Rules of the Game and 4K.
I saw.
4K. Maybe overkill for that film, but... Yeah, I'll probably end up getting it. Who knows? I don't know. I actually don't have any Renoir. So it would be Day of the Country. Yeah. I think the reason that French films are so prominent on there is the fact that you have that burst in the 20s, 30s, 40s with like him and La Talante and stuff.
I mean,
and
so,
then
yeah.
you have the French New Wave, which is just so key.
Cinema was born in France. And
yeah, that's true.
I mean, I guess now and then I think about it, it makes sense, but it's just like, it's almost like we're doing a bit at this point. Like, we just keep doing French movies.
Because we're following the list.
I know.
We're ping-ponging.
I know.
Anyway, yeah, we'd love to have you guys come back next week. Until then, I'm Greg.
I'm Jackie.
And we'll see you next time.
Bye.
Seen and Heard is an official podcast of the Arroyo Film Club, featuring Greg Kleinschmidt and Jacqueline Postagian. Theme music by Andrew Cox. If you like what you heard, don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review. If you have any questions, comments, or you just want to say hi, email us hello@seenandheardpod.com or visit our website, www.seenandheardpod.com.